Hey everyone, it's Quentin Stark, Stark Insider. We're talking about Game 1, Sharks and Canucks. I have on the phone with me up in Vancouver, filmmaker Aaron Houston, who joins us once again for the conversation. Thanks, Aaron, for jumping in again.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, in Game 1, there's a lot of storylines. You know, I think there was almost a fight before they even dropped the puck. They talked about the Sharks' fatigue. Luongo had another little nice play in the first period. God, there's any number of storylines, and I want to get to that. Before I do, I should make a confession, and I mentioned this to you, Aaron, last time. I missed the game. You know, I am a huge Sharks fan. I love the NHL playoffs. I had to miss Game 1, and just one of the things I had to do, we had a benefit event we had to go up to Sunday in San Francisco, and it's an annual cause for Meals on Wheels, and it's a really great organization, so It was the right thing to do, and I followed the game along on SportsTap, which is this little application I have on my Droid, so I could follow the score. So
yep.
You know, I was sneaking under the table, you know, in between courses or in between conversation and checking the score. It looked to me like the Sharks were actually playing a pretty good road game. You know, it was 1-0, and then 1-1, and then Sharks came back again and took a 2-1 lead into the third, and then, of course, Vancouver came back and won Game 1, 3-2. So for them, it was a comeback, and for the Sharks, it was another third-period letdown. But I should let you do most of the talking because I'm assuming you watched the game.
Yeah. Luongo was playing the puck in the first period. I mean, I used to have half-season tickets with a friend of mine, and it was sort of this thing where, like, you know, everybody – anytime Luongo went to play the puck, there was this sort of, you know, tense moment or whatever. I mean, he's not the best at playing the puck. They say it's because he's, you know, naturally right-handed or whatever, and he has to shoot with his left. But, it's not a good thing when he plays the puck sometimes.
Yeah, that one looked like he almost played it. Like, he was almost trying. I know he was trying to pass it beyond Joe Thornton, but, man, that was a pretty bad play for a goaltender to make. I mean, I could see why he got nervous every time he handles the puck.
Yeah. There's a lot of that, like, where, you know, he just goes to ringing around the boards and it just doesn't get there. And, like, you know, a lot of us feel like just leave it alone, let somebody else get it, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah.
Niemi, I think
the first goal of the Canucks scored too. Niemi had sort of a similar play. It didn't look as bad. Like, it wasn't as, you know, right on the Canucks stick kind of thing, but he rung it around the boards a little too hard. And that's how we got our first goal too.
What was the overall feeling in the city over the Canucks Game 1 performance?
Pretty good. I mean, the first period and a half or whatever, it was pretty evenly matched. And then once there, I don't know if you saw the highlight, but there was this sort of like goal line stand where there was this huge scrum in front of the Sharks net.
That was unreal. I did see it.
Yeah. But from that point on, it sort of seemed like the Canucks took over. Like, their play in the third period, they just, like, really outplayed San Jose in the third period. They were, you know, hustling after the puck. They were hitting. They were, you know, I think the final shots were 38 or 39 shots or something. But there was also, like, 25 block shots by the Sharks. So the Canucks were really coming on strong in the third period there. So everybody sort of feels that if they play with that kind of intensity, you know, for the rest of the series or for a whole game or whatever, that people are feeling pretty good about it.
Right. And I think I've been reading a lot of people have been, of course, we critique the game, you know, looking for any excuse or any kind of interesting headline. And one of them is, of course, the Sharks went to a pretty long Game 7 series in the second round. And so some people were talking about fatigue, you know, maybe being a factor in the third period. But maybe not. You know, this is a trend that we've seen the entire playoffs, is that the Sharks are giving up leads in the third period. And I can't remember the exact stat. I had it here a second ago. But they're being outscored, and the third period is not a good period for the Sharks. But which is odd, because during the regular season, they had a great record. Whenever they took a lead in the third period after 40 minutes, they were a strong team in closing out the opposition.
Yeah, because that happened in the Detroit. Yeah, I saw that stat too. I think they're like 1-4 or something in the series with San Jose or whatever, and they're outscored like 9-3 in the third period or something like that. can't remember what it was, the Sharks. Yeah, and it kind of happened with the Canucks a few times during the playoffs too, which is funny because same thing, like during the season, I think they're the best team carrying a lead in the third period. They'd only lost like one or two games. I think they lost one or two games in regulation all season long when they had a lead going into the third period. So, but it's playoff hockey, right? It's kind of different, you know, like if you're down by a goal going into the third period in the playoffs, so sometimes it gives you that extra boost of energy to really come on strong, which is kind of what the Canucks did in game one, right? So.
Now, what about, have you guys heard about, this is like the soap opera aspect of the playoffs, Dan Boyle's accusing the Vancouver Canucks of taking, you know, exaggerating their penalties. He said, quote, their heads are going back like they've been shot with a gun. he said when they're being checked, you know. And so I don't know if that's true or not. I doubt it. I'm sure there's a little bit of that on both sides of the clock.
Yeah. Well, we were sort of accused of that in the Nashville series too. So I don't know. I don't know if they're actually really getting hurt or if they're just good at drawing penalties or what. So I think we got a diving penalty in the third period though on the in game one, didn't we? Boyle took a penalty, didn't he, late in the game?
Well, that would be funny. That'd be ironic. I'd have to check out the. See, I didn't see the game, so.
Yeah, I think he got a penalty, and then I can't remember who it was that he checked, but whoever it was took a diving penalty.
Oh yeah, LaPierre.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So they did call a dive on LaPierre in the third period. So, anyways. All little storylines. So, you know, it's interesting because I guess it was probably a decent result for game one for both sides. I mean, of course, the Sharks, we'd like to come away with the win and not give up the lead. But on the other hand, they're coming off a tough game seven, a seven-game series against Detroit, and they played a pretty decent road game for the most part, except for the third period. And Vancouver did what they're supposed to do. They came out and they're supposed to win, you know, at least one. Well, they're supposed to win both games at home. So what we can hope for tonight in game two is obviously taking the split back home into San Jose.
Yeah. And I think Niemi played really well other than, you know, I think what the Canucks sort of started to figure out was to go high on him. You know, like everything low, he was stopping in the, you know, if they take more shots high that they'll have a better opportunity. But he's a really good goalie. You know, like he's the one thing on the Shark side is he hasn't lost a playoff series.
Right, and he's won a Stanley Cup, right? I mean, he's the last season. Yeah. He knows what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw that goal. Again, I had to watch the replay. I saw the goal line stand you were talking about. That was quite amazing. I mean, I think Dean Brown in Ottawa would have said, scramble, like, just falling out of their chair.
Yeah, we were yelling at the TV. We couldn't believe that it didn't go in.
Yeah, it was pretty bizarre. So what do you think is going to happen tonight, I guess? What's your prediction for this, of course, is game two, Wednesday night, starts at, 6 o'clock Pacific. I'm going to be out at doing a segment for Stark Insider on location, and I got to get the heck out of there and get back and see the game this time. But what do you think is going to happen?
I don't know. I mean, it'll sort of depend on the energy. Like, I think that both teams are pretty evenly matched. Like I said, the first period and a half was seemed like pretty even game, and then the third period, it just seemed like the Canucks were all over them. Like even when there was only a couple minutes left and they had a goalie pulled, they couldn't really get anything going for San Jose. So I think it depends on the energy level between the two teams. Like I still think that it's going to be a pretty intense series, and I think it could go either way. You know, again, I'm hoping for the Canucks, right? But I think it should be an exciting game.
My prediction is going to be Vancouver is going to take the lead, and I think San Jose is going to come back and win this one. I think it's going to be another one-goal game. I mean, I don't know that's too out there in terms of predictions because there's been so many one-goal games in the Western Conference, and they've been low-scoring games. I mean, look at Tampa Bay-Boston. That's an 80s-style shootout series over there on the East Coast.
That was great. Did you watch the game last night?
I saw parts of it, yes. I mean, it was
at
the gym and watching part of it on the elliptical, and it was fun to watch. That's kind of, you know, exciting game to watch.
Yeah. I watched the game, and it's, being up 6-3, and then they came back 6-5, and then I couldn't believe that they didn't score in the end. Like, you know, there was a couple of saves that Thomas made there that, you know, I think Boston was really lucky to come away with the win. But yeah, it was really fun to watch. You know, like it's nice to watch, you know, high scoring games and wide open games like that. There was lots of looks and lots of chances and stuff. So I think for San Jose or Vancouver, it's going to be an interesting final. If especially if Tampa Bay gets through, they're just, you know, they're a powerhouse team.
Right, totally different styles of play, I think, the West Coast versus the East Coast. So that, and you're right, Vancouver and San Jose, I think either team's going to be pretty interesting to see again in the final, yeah, in terms of the two different styles of play.
Yeah.
All right, we're talking about the Sharks and the Canucks, NHL playoffs round three, Western Conference Finals with Aaron Houston. He's a filmmaker out of Vancouver. For those that don't know, you're working on your first feature film. You've done short films before, and the feature film is Sunflower Hour, or is it The Sunflower Hour?
I'm not really yeah, sure. Sunflower Hour.
Sunflower Hour, it's a mockumentary, and why don't you quickly just recap kind of what the film's about and where you're at in terms of the process. We're like talking about hockey, a little bit of film, because you're in Vancouver, which is Hollywood North, in a sense, rivalry with Toronto, perhaps, for that title. I don't know what your thought is on
that. Yeah. Yeah, but the film's a mockumentary about sort of the underbelly of puppeteering and what it really takes to make it in children's television. And it follows these four puppeteers who are trying to land a spot on a popular children's television show. And we're just in post-production now. We're almost done, actually. We're doing our final sound mix dates June 6th and 7th, and then we'll have a final output a few days after that. So, yeah, pretty excited.
Yeah. You're the director, and last time we spoke, you were, I think, working on some sound mix and maybe the soundtrack or so forth. But I wanted to know, how does that work? I mean, when you're the director directing the scenes and the film itself, what's your level of involvement and what's your role once the film's gone into post-production?
Well, for this one, I wrote it as well, and I'm producing it with my producing partner. So in the post-production process on this one, my involvement is pretty heavy. Like we sort of self-finance this film. So, I mean, it's just basically Greg, our editor, and I have been working on it a lot and working on the music a lot and involved in every part of the process. It's our passion project, right? So, yeah, involved from everything to... from color correction to sound mix and sound design and music and yeah, everything.
And you're using, I think you're using Final Cut Pro, is that right?
Yeah, we're cutting on Final Cut, yeah.
On Final Cut Pro. And then let's briefly, I think we might have talked about this, there's another podcast of you and I talking just about your film. And of course, I'll put a link to that. And we've been talking about the Sharks because both our cities made it into the conference finals. And but I wanted to ask you about distribution on your film.
Yeah.
I think you got a head start on it this year, or kind of where is that progressing, or where do you expect that to go?
Well, we had up in Canada, we have a Telefilm Canada, which is like a government organization to sort of help out filmmakers and is like a financing program and helps out in a lot of different ways. And they had a screening in New York for international distributors and picked our film to be one that they showed some clips from. And so we got some interest from that and from some fairly big companies and stuff. So that was kind of cool because, I mean, it's just this little, you know, $25,000 film that we made. And so I think that because we don't have any huge stars or anything like that, that the distribution process will be interesting because I think it'll depend on a lot, like on our festival selections and what the critics have to say and, you know, sort of building a grassroots kind of campaign ourselves as well, you know, through social media like YouTube and Facebook, you know, how many, you know, nowadays how many likes you have on Facebook or, you know, you can get a general interest from the public kind of thing and be able to go to a distributor and go, look, we have like, you know, 20,000 people who like this on Facebook, you know, there are people who want to see it kind of thing. Because you basically with distributors, you have to show them where it's going to make money. They don't really care necessarily how much, well, certain distributors will, but how artistic it is or anything. They want to know, you know, can we make money on this? Are we going to lose money on it, or are we going to make money? It's sort of about the bottom line when you get to that part of the process, right? So the onus is sort of on us to show them that there is an audience for this, I think.
Yeah, I guess there's, of course, it's all about risk, right? So they're going to take a risk in investing in your film, and then they're expecting hopefully to make their money back and then some, of course. And so I guess if you can show them, look, we have this built-in audience, I guess nothing's guaranteed, but at least, you know, if you have a certain amount of interest through social media, perhaps that can reduce some of the risks in the eyes of the investors, at least.
Yeah, because even though our film was, you know, cost, you know, basically nothing in terms of, you know, how much film costs to make, for them to, you know, do a theatrical run, or even just making prints and small print and advertising and you know, DVDs and all that kind of stuff still can cost in the millions of dollars, you know, just to get it out there kind of thing. So they need to know that there's an audience that they can recoup that money. So it's still, you know, a bit of a risk for them, you know, even though it didn't cost us very much to make the film. So it's not the same as, like, you know, Warner Brothers making $100 million movie. But for some of these, you know, boutique distributors, or even a distributor like Warner Brothers, there still is money that is involved that just has to get paid if you're gonna do a theatrical release or do any kind of advertising or that kind of stuff, right? So
right. I was watching, I think Kevin Smith made a big splash at I'm trying to think. He's always making a splash, you know, Kevin Smith, Clerks, the film director.
Yeah. He's at Sundance, I think it was.
On which one?
At Sundance, I think it was. Are you talking about his new film?
Yeah, that's right, Sundance. Yeah, that's right. And he's pretty active on Twitter, too. And he's always good at making, generating controversy and headlines, kind of like Michael Moore, I guess, is on the documentary side. But he was talking about exactly that. You know, the cost of making films these days, the bar is actually so low. I mean, probably the biggest budget line item is for the big films anyways, is salaries, right, for the big stars.
Yeah.
But what's unfair, I think, in some of these independent film festivals is you actually have big money behind some of these small films, and they can spend $4, $5, $10 million on sales and marketing, a small independent film, which kind of defeats the purpose, I thought, of these independent film festivals. It just seems like some of the rules of the game are changing in that regard.
Yeah.
For better or worse, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I think we're kind of at a place now where things are starting to bridge. Like, I think that, you know, just like when VHS first came out, you know, the studios and the distribution companies and stuff were very much against it, right? Because it would kill the theater experience and they would lose money and all that kind of stuff. And then it proved not to be. And then now, you know, a lot of the studios are sort of, you know, have been fearful of the internet, you know, and pirating and how to distribute on the internet and same kind of thing. But I mean, you know, you have to sort of give the audience what it wants. You know, if somebody wants to sit at home and download their movie, or, you know, all that kind of, like, you know, you're seeing nowadays certain trends where they're starting to catch up, you know, like a movie will be in the theater and it won't even be finished its theater run, or like a month after it's done its theater run, it's out on DVD right away, or it's on iTunes right away, because they know that people want to have their options, you know. So things are sort of changing, and it is possible now, because it used to be like a handful of people decided for us what we could watch, what we could listen to, you know, all these executives at the studios and stuff, and or at the record labels and that kind of stuff. We didn't have a way of sort of sharing with each other or discussing it amongst ourselves kind of thing in the way that we do now with the internet. So now it's possible to, you know, put a trailer or a film on YouTube and have it become successful without even having dealt with the distributor. You know,
right.
And there was actually a web series up here that happened with, called Grease. And one of the actors that's in our film, actually two of the actors that are in our film were in the web series, and they did it themselves, and they did a self-distribution on the web and got this huge following for it, and ended up selling it to Sci-Fi in the States just from their YouTube hits and their, you know, followers on Facebook and all that kind of stuff. So, like, it's possible to sort of carve your own path now in a way that it never was before, where somebody had to, you know, hand that to you before, where now you can go after it yourself and find your own audience, you know.
For sure. I mean, look at in the music industry, like a Justin Bieber, right, out of
Yeah.
Canada on YouTube, becoming a star there first.
Yeah.
And
So it's changed the game a lot now.
Right.
You know, like.
I was reading this morning that, and I wrote about this on Stark Insider, small plug there, that Netflix is generating almost, I think, 30%, according to a report that came out yesterday, 30% of internet traffic is being generated by Netflix. And then if you factor in YouTube and iTunes and a couple of the other video services, I think it's almost 50%, half of all traffic is coming through these, you know, video streaming services, because I think a lot of people are doing what we're doing here in our household, which is we canceled satellite and we use Netflix, we use Vudu, Hulu, we use Skype a lot. I mean, we don't have a home phone line. There's no such thing as a landline anymore. Everything's going through that internet pipe. You know, it's voice, video, and data, which was just like the 90s was in telecom. So it's all coming to
be. Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, like all of the video stores here are all shutting down. You know, like even our boutique ones and stuff are all closing down. And Blockbuster, I mean, half the stores are gone. And you know, we have Rogers Video up here, and half their stores are gone. You know, like it's easier to sit at home and be able to click on a mouse than you know, drive all the way to the store, pick something out, drive all the way back. Then you got to bring the video. You know what I mean? Like, so it's, you know, they sort of. I think there's a lot of catch up to be done with you know, consumer demand, you know.
Right, and there's the price of gas, of course, and then I guess other devices are changing the movie experience or the television watching experience, like the iPad, for example. So people aren't just sitting on their couch, I don't think, anymore. You know, the whole game is kind of, it's on the go and it's changing. Before I forget, you mentioned, we talked about film festivals just a little bit, Sundance and so forth. Are you able to share that news yet, or you still can't reveal the film festival you got into?
No, we can't yet. I don't think that they announce it until 2 weeks before. I might actually email them and ask them when we can start talking about it. But it's a pretty big, like, international festival, and we're really excited about it. But yeah, as soon as we can, we'll definitely let you know.
Okay, I'll keep checking. So Sunflower Hour, that's going to be one of these big international film festivals. We'll find out soon which one. And meantime, okay, let's wrap up. But before we do, let's do a little prediction. I want a score from you. What's your score in the game for tonight?
4-2 Canucks.
Sorry, say it again there.
4-2 Canucks.
4-2 Canucks. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to go 3-1 for San Jose. I have a feeling we're always going to be predicting our own teams here. I'm going to go for a two-goal win, 3-1. Well, you're going for a two-goal win, too, the other way.
Yeah.
4-2 for you, for the Canucks, and I'll say 3-1 for the Sharks. That's Aaron Houston's prediction, and I'm Clint Stark. And thanks for joining us. Aaron, come back and join us tomorrow. We'll talk about game two. That'd be possible.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
all right, woman, thanks for joining us. This is Clint from Stark Inside. We'll talk to you tomorrow.